Good morning. It is 8:33, October 18th, 2024. This is an informal hearing on the application or reapplication, I'm not sure what the right term would be, for Harmony Solar Project. It's case number PU-18-219. In a few moments, we'll go around and have everybody at the table introduce themselves. I'd ask you to also state your title so we better know who to maybe direct questions to. Commissioner Haugenhofer, did you have any comments before we get started?
No, I don't, except good morning, everyone, and thanks for being here.
And Commissioner Fedorchak?
No opening comments.
Okay, and then also before we go around, I just want to emphasize this is an informal hearing, so we deal in only undisputed information. If there is disputed information, we'll have to wrap this up and reschedule it into a formal hearing. With that, if you want to just go around the table and first and last names and positions, please.
Victor Shook with PSC staff.
John Shook, PSC staff.
Molly Smith, Frederickson Byron, outside counsel.
Ali Mohammed, the National Grid Renewables permitting specialist.
Amber Miller, National Grid Renewables permitting director.
Jay Hess, National Grid Renewables senior director of development.
Davis, environmental consultant with Emergent.
I'm Maddie Godin, associate developer.
Cole Euchre, local 49.
Thanks for being here, Cole. Okay, so with that, we usually have the applicant go first on an informal hearing, so I'll turn it over to Molly, and you can take it away as you choose.
That sounds good. So I just wanted to let you know in front of you is a copy of the presentation that Alia is going to go through today. The maps are basically duplicates of what are in the presentation, but some of them were harder to see if they were on one sheet, so we provided some separate sheets of the maps, so those are together. And then the last documents are just the executed CUP that we provided on Tuesday, and then additional correspondence with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Game and Fish that was also provided on Tuesday. With that, I'll turn it over to Alia to go through the presentation.
Good morning. Oh, there you go. Good morning. I'm happy to be presenting to you today. Please feel free to stop me if you have questions at all during the presentation. If you have questions, I will try to answer them, or Amber or Jay, but we also have a team on the call as well. So please feel free to introduce yourselves. I think we can start off with Rafiq.
Good morning. My name is Rafiq Halim. I'm the Director of Transmission for National Grid Renewables. Happy to be here.
And then we have Michael Morris.
Hi, good morning. Michael Morris. I'm Senior Director of Data Science with National Grid Renewables. So I oversee a lot of our technology evaluation and energy production estimate functions.
And we have Brett Schneider.
Yeah, hi, Brett Schneider, Director of Construction Projects with National Grid Renewables.
And Mike Scores.
We can't hear you, Mike, just so you know.
I see you unmuted yourself, but we're unable to hear you. You want to check your audio settings?
Okay. I think Justin is on as well.
Hey, good morning. Hopefully everyone can hear me. Justin Picard, Senior Director of Origination. I lead our sales efforts in SPP MISO region. good morning, and thanks for having me.
And then we have Carl.
Good morning. I'm Carl Kostrick, Wildlife Program Manager at Tetra Tech.
Perfect. All right. We'll start off.
So which button makes it go down?
I think the, where's the, where's she aiming
which
at, Matt?
Which screen should she be aiming?
Okay. Is it the center button?
There.
Oh, there we go. All right. We'll start off with the permitting timeline. So we were issued our certificate of site compatibility for Harmony Solar on February 26, 2019. Oh. And since then, we've been working to secure a couple of agreements, and that includes our interconnection agreement and our power purchase agreement. I can say that we have secured both. Jay will talk about that in a couple more slides. So as we know, we submitted our application for certification of continuing suitability on July 31st of this year. Just a few notes along with that, our project area remains the same. There's just a few minor design updates. Also in preparation, we've engaged in coordination with state, federal, and local agencies to obtain any additional feedback on the project. We've also obtained an updated CUP from Harmony Township, as well as an updated letter of support from Cass County.
I just want to interrupt you with a couple questions.
Yes.
When was the CUP updated? Did you say the county or the township?
Harmony Township, yeah, it was last year of 2023.
Okay. And in 2019, did you have both the interconnection and the power purchase agreement, or neither, or just one, or where were you with that?
We had neither. Okay. Yeah. So we did submit additional information a couple of days ago on October 15th. That includes our agency correspondence with U.S. Fish and Game and Wildlife, North Dakota Game and Fish. So we do have those handouts as well if you haven't looked at those yet. And then our fully executed Harmony Township CUP is also in the handout as well. So our request to the commission today is certification of continuing suitability, and this is supported by our affidavit for certification of continuing suitability, Exhibit 1, environmental report, along with several appendices, and then Exhibit 2, certificate of site compatibility chart. Then now we have our project map here. So again, the project boundary in red, it's remained the same. It's located in Cass County and in Harmony Township. It's approximately 1,662 acres, all agricultural land, and it'll be a 200 megawatt facility.
And that's 1,662. I kind of had time to go through this when you first sent it out. Now it's been a while. That's the same amount and the same acres.
Yes, it's the same.
First time around, right?
Yep, exactly.
You said you have leases, or in the filing you say you have the leases with the landowners. Were those, did you have to extend those? We don't get involved in that, but you have them all. There's none outstanding.
That's correct.
There's no questions.
They were refreshed and extended. Yep.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. And there's no current issues with those at all. You have the ability to use all of that land.
Correct.
As of now.
Yep.
Okay.
All Now I'd like to share some of our updated studies that we've completed. So our first one for cultural reports, we have an updated class one cultural resource literature search completed. Just to confirm that no additional inventories were completed in the project vicinity. We also have a couple of environmental reports that we've done. This includes our unanticipated discoveries plan, which was submitted of this year. We didn't have one originally in the 2018 application, but we have one now. Also, our wetland delineations were also updated last year as well, and I'll talk about those in a few more slides. Our vegetation management plan. So previously, with our original plan, we coordinated with Cass County Soil Conservation District to approve the seed mixes. And since then, we've sent our plan to North Dakota Department of Agriculture, and they suggested that we update section 2.4 of the seed compliance section, basically saying that if a seed doesn't have a seed tag, that we would coordinate with North Dakota State Seed Department and run an analysis on those seeds if they don't have a seed tag.
And I would just add that Cass County asked that it be sent to the Department of Agriculture for review. So they did direct that communication.
And so then the Department of Agriculture asked that you update that one section.
Yep.
And did they approve that then?
Yep. And then we also sent that updated plan to Cass County's Weed Control Department as well.
Good. I have a question.
Yeah.
On the U.S. Department of Interior letter, it's just a recommendation of the studies. Are you guys going to participate in those?
Yeah. I don't know if Amber wants to speak to that.
You're referring to the
U.S. Fish.
UN Fish and Wildlife and the
birds.
The birds, yeah. So, so we have had coordination with both North Dakota Fish and Game and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. The studies that were proposed by U.S. Fish and Wildlife, we have met with a group that is doing a study, and we're corresponding back and forth. We're not quite sure that their study times out. They want to do post-construction, and their study times out in 2027 for post-construction, so they're not sure this site is a good fit. So they're looking at some of our other sites. So, but we're still looking at it, and there's another group that we've talked to for that particular piece of the post-construction monitoring. We have worked with we received a letter from Fish and Game and making specific recommendations. We met with U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Fish and Game, and our consultants developed a site-specific plan as opposed to just general recommendations for post-construction, 1 year of post-construction mortality monitoring for the water-based fowl in the site. We already did a pre-construction bird use study, and we will conduct a post-construction bird use study. Mm-hmm. There were 7 species found in the initial pre-construction study, and we expect that once the post-construction study is completed, that will show increased bird species and biodiversity in the site.
What's your closest water to your site, like a slough or some type of water?
Well, there are wetlands adjacent to the site.
That's the word I was looking for. Wetlands.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking, but
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and I can add, if you look at Figure 6, it shows the water features. And there's a couple of little riverines that go just on the edge. There's not really a lot of water in this area. So, but in the past, based on and our experts that have shared this, they understand that that has been the main concern, is that there's a potential for waterfowl either migrating through to be impacted. That's what they wanted to research. It's not showing impacts, but that's what they want to confirm, basically. And I think just to add a little bit to what Amber said, there's a series of letters. So there's some original
recommendations, and that may be what you were looking at as kind of the original high level. This is what we typically see for wind. You might consider doing this for solar. After that, they had a meeting with Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and talked about the different studies they were doing, got their buy-in that they had done what was needed for pre-construction surveys, and then talked about post-construction. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recommended maybe partnering with this other group that's doing like a national study. The issue is we're not sure that we can get the results of that study. The timing was not, like, they're kind of a ways out. So that's why Amber was talking about doing a site-specific study. It kind of seemed like might have to do both and may not be able to use the data the same way that Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wanted. So that's part of the reason they developed this dual. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to see pre-use, post-use, and Game and Fish was more looking at mortality. And so this is a blending of the two to create a specific for this site, which is agriculture, because Game and Fish's concerns are typically grassland, wetland concerns. So this is kind of a site specific.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One more follow-up on that. So you kind of outlined that plan in this letter, right?
Correct.
Do you have a response from Game and Fish to this?
No, we didn't get a response from Game and Fish. It was prepared after getting some input from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay.
But we didn't get further comments from them.
Do you? What was your last exchange with Game and Fish?
The last one would be in the agency correspondence, and there may be actually with that letter there is an email chain.
Yeah.
And that email chain should have the last kind of exchange that happened right before this.
That's with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, though.
And Game and Fish. Both are, there should be two of them, but
I don't see any signers from from Game and Fish.
So if you go to Appendix I, Game and Fish, there's a slip sheet about halfway through that says state agencies, or maybe a little bit more, and Game and Fish is the first agency. And we have kind of the entirety of the exchange between Game and Fish and the project outlined in these emails. The last exchange, they were asking for 2 years post-construction mortality monitoring.
And is that what you've settled on?
No, because it's based on the fact that they have concerns about grassland and waterfowl, and there are no grasslands at this site. So we've tried to take that general recommendation and turn it into a site-specific recommendation that meets both agencies' concerns, which is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants to see pre- and post-use because they are less concerned with the count of the birds mm-hmm. that may be impacted, but more seeing if it does change the use of the site. So that's the part that's one half of the study. The other half is doing a one-year mortality monitoring post-construction with the results shared and further coordination as needed if the results are not what is expected, which is expected to be low.
So why does the presence of the wetlands change the length of the follow-up? Like, it seemed like you said, Molly, that the 2 years was driven by the fact that there was wetlands in the area. Did I misunderstand?
I probably misstated. So Game and Fish in their letter talks about their concern with impacts because of sites being within grassland and near wetlands. In this site, there are no wetlands that are permanent. These are kind of like there's a farmed wetland and then a little area along the riverine. Mm-hmm. And they're not full-time wetlands, and it's all ag land, so it's not grassland. So the site seems, based on all of the expert input from, and Carl's the expert that we have on, this isn't a site that would warrant doing the same type of post-construction mortality monitoring that a site would potentially
with other circumstances.
So when you say that you do it for, you'll do it for a year with additional consultation, that says to me that if Game and Fish or Fish and Wildlife or anybody had concerns about the results of that, you'd do it for another year.
I think that's the commitment. Yeah. Okay. If they came back, basically if they came back and didn't come back as anticipated, which are anticipated to be low impacts, then yes, that was the extension.
Okay.
I mean, part of it is just trying to meet the asks of both two different entities, kind of seeing things two different ways, and it's in part because Solar's new.
Well, to that point, I doubt that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife would be opposed to another year of monitoring. Mm. You know, like I doubt that they'd say, oh, no, please don't do that. So it seems like that would be something because of the newness. Maybe that's why Game and Fish is looking for that. But as long as you guys are open to doing that based on the results, and we can kind of include that in our discussion and in the order, I think that's a fair way to handle it.
Okay.
I want to ask you this in farmer language. On page 7 of your...
Farmer language. Is that a separate dictionary?
The middle slide. Maybe there's other reasons. It would sort of look like on that one, you're not going to the south end of that corridor because of that lowland that flows through there. When they farm that currently, is that just a low spot that might be wet for them sometimes? Or do they lift their tillage up and go around that and that grass grows in that valley?
It's the latter. They don't farm through that corridor there south of our panels.
Yeah,
that's more of an ongoing drainage ditch. It's like the rush. It's like a rush. I think Rush River Water District has that drainage agreements through there. So yeah, that's intended to deal with the runoff and flooding. And there are agreements there to allow drainage.
And so this piece that you're not developing, that whole piece is not even farmed. Not just the valley. That's
It's right now it's farmed up to the edge of that, but just not in that corridor ditch thing you're looking
at. Okay, now I got it. Thank you.
Yep.
I'm just going to wrap up this slide and mention a couple of other reports that we've completed. So our glare analysis was updated in July of this year. It's reported that there's no glare, especially seen from residences and roadways. Also, we've completed pre-construction bird use surveys as well, which was voluntary. In North Dakota, Game of Fish did deem those as sufficient.
Can you talk a little bit more about the glare analysis? Again, this has been a while since we permitted this, so refresh my memory. What is that? How do you study that? And what kind of concerns are you seeing in other places with glare analysis? Like, what can be the problem?
Michael, could you answer that question?
Sure. So, two primary concerns there based around the reflection of light off of either the panels or off of some of the ancillary equipment, supporting structures, things like that. One is impacts to drivers on roadways in and near the project. The other is on, aviation in and near and above the project. And the intent of the glare analysis is to basically calculate the reflection angle of the sun. The solar position is calculated at each interval throughout the year. And similarly, we know the orientation of the solar panels, all of the equipment within the project. And so we can use a mathematical model to just calculate, okay, the sun is here, the panels are here. That means that any reflection will go in this direction and use that to estimate what the likelihood or the frequency is of glare occurring on one of those affected surfaces, either the roadways or, a plane taking an assumed path over or near the project.
Mm-hmm. Is there a certain tolerance standard for glare that's generally followed by the industry in nationally or in other states or established in any way?
So primarily what they look at is, and I forget what the exact technical term is, but it's basically the amount, the concentration of the light or the intensity of the light. We might be able to follow up and get the exact terminology there. But it's basically broken. There's sort of a red, yellow, green chart that the FAA and Department of Transportation has produced as sort of a way to classify the intensity of the light into safe, potentially hazardous in certain conditions, or hazardous and to be avoided. And what we seek to do is keep that in the green area as frequently as possible.
Mm-hmm. And where are those results in this application?
It is found in Appendix F.
Okay. And just to summarize those, how does it this project fare in terms of the red, yellow, green?
All the results were green.
All of them were green. I'm thinking of, when somebody on a plane has their phone a certain way and they're and it's glaring at you across three aisles or three seats. You don't know what to do about that.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that some projects, what they can say is that, as Michael indicated, they look at the our panels move, so they look at where they're pointed during certain times of the day, and comparison to roadways or structures and. If they think that something's going to flare yellow, that can be adjusted by the tilt of the panel during that particular time of year. Also, if they think there's going to be any kind of impact to the roadways, now this didn't happen on this particular project, but I've had it happen on other projects where they just have us, move back 5 feet and then the glare is no longer yellow, it's green. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty easy fix.
Yes.
And you can program these things to be set in a certain way at a certain time of year.
Yep.
Without a lot of monitoring or... cool.
And all your panels are the tilt, right?
Yep. Yeah. Tracks the sun throughout the day. Yep.
Our next slide here is our current project design. We also have a handout for you that shows us in a bigger picture for figure two. I'm just going to point out a few things here. So the project boundary in red still unchanged. You can see the solar array in the green shaded area. The dotted line is the fence line surrounding the solar array. And then the existing substation is in yellow over here. And then our substation and O&M facility in the pink box right there. And then also our blue transmission line.
And that transmission line is still as it was 6 years ago, less than a mile.
So it's less than a mile. It's a little different now. It's shorter than what it was previously.
So how long is it?
0.4, yeah.
Still less than a mile. Farmer
talk. I was curious if it was 5,200 feet or 100 feet.
And then this slide here, so we overlaid our 2018 design with our new design just to show the minor changes that we have. So again, the project boundary is in red. The solar array, the current one, is in green. in the previous design, it is the light blue shaded area. Also, the inverters are in orange currently. Previously, they were in black. Also want to point out here, get my laser, this residence right here is participating with the project, and they're approximately 1,033 feet away from the solar array. The laydown yards currently are in pink. Previously, they're in this hashed-looking area. And then our O&M facility and substation, again, is in pink here. Previously, it was in this blue box. And then that dotted line was our previous transmission line, and now it's this blue one, which is shorter to the existing substation in yellow.
Why the changes? Why the move of the your O&M and the changes?
I can talk about it. So it's just a kind of, I guess, an advancement of the design over time. And one of the couple key features here is just that this design does enable us to reduce the overhead line crossings. There's a couple east and west existing transmission lines there. So with this new design, our collection system underground will come from the site under those, under the existing transmission lines to our collector substation. And so it just is a little bit more efficient there. And then also on the road to the O&M, this reduces the need to build more roads. And we use that the road that is going to the current existing substation there, and then just extend it and build that up a little bit.
What's the, has the capacity factor of this changed at all in the, with the updated technology?
That's a Michael question.
Michael, yeah. Michael, can you comment on that?
Sure. So the industry has definitely evolved in the past 6 years since the original approval. I would say without having the number in front of me, though, I would say the capacity factor has probably increased by 1 to 2%. So that's driven by a couple of things. One is just a more efficient, a more efficient design with some of the newer solar panels. They have a higher nameplate rating per unit, so we're able to space them out a little bit more and reduce the amount of shading in between rows. And then also, modern solar panels are able to collect irradiance on the backside of the panel. So we refer to these as bifacial units. And that's something that wasn't really popular until about 4 years ago, when the technology sort of became a little bit more more stable and commercially available. And so right now, the plan is that this product will be built with those bifacial units, and that also increases the energy production somewhat.
And what approximately was or is the capacity factor?
It's 24% now, and I think it was in the 19 to 23, 22 range previously.
Could you provide sort of the seasonal capacity factors? Just, it's more of a curiosity than anything. Since this is the first time in North Dakota, I'd love to know, like, in the summer, what does it look like versus in the middle of January? Even the four seasons, if there's an average, or if it's a monthly thing, however you want to provide that, that'd be helpful.
Okay. Yep.
And, I don't know if this would impact if you're looking for it in a different way, but if the high end, if you could tell us about when that is, like, so it seems my instinct is that the high end would be when the days are the longest in late June, because that would seem like it would be hours of sunlight that would impact it, not the heat. And that the short would be around Christmas time. So maybe instead of January, like if we could do the high point and the low point.
Okay. Michael.
Yeah.
Seasonal.
Michael, do you want to comment about that generally? We can provide a report too, but do you just want to talk generally about that production through the season?
Sure. And I was actually able to just pull up the last energy production run we did. So now looking at kind of the what we would consider the winter time, so November, December, January, average capacity factor is about 10%. springtime, you know, it increases pretty rapidly, 17% to about 30% in May. And then in what we would consider the summertime, it's about 35 to 40%. And then you sort of see a similar drop off as we kind of go from the summer to the wintertime.
That's close enough for me.
So summer was 35%?
Yeah, about 35%.
Okay.
Did you say 35 to 40?
So 35 is like an average of June, July, August.
Okay.
So July is the month with the highest average capacity factor at just over 40%. And you know, I can provide these monthly results in in a table if that's of interest.
Yeah, that sounds good, Michael. Thank you.
It explains why my solar Christmas lights never came on. thought it was such a great idea. could you?
It's better left unsaid.
What about talk about the technology for dealing with the snow?
It might be a Brett. Yeah, it might be a Brett question.
Or Michael.
It
depends on what you want to know. Like, if you want to talk about like snow load, that's my question. I don't know if Brett
how
or Michael
deal with it. I mean, basically, there's and maybe you don't care because it's 10%, Ben. But
Mike, do you want to talk about that? We have our operations. I don't know. Is your mic working now?
Oh yeah.
I've seen panels where they rotate in the snowfall with the tilt, just the heat automatically takes a lot of it off.
Yep.
So
that's exactly right.
Mike, is that you?
But what if there is no heat?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Like the you know, in a storm and when it's snowing like 18
inches.
Yes,
we can hear you, Mike.
It just feels like that could be overwhelmed.
And sorry for the mic issues earlier. I just quickly introducing myself on Mike Scores. I'm our director of health, safety, environmental training for National Grid. So super nice to meet you all. I'll call it a limited knowledge of the systems, just dealing with the ops folks on a daily basis. We have MET weather stations, MET tower weather stations throughout the projects generally. They have sensor kits that are basically put onto the backs of panels, and they measure, they're connected to the MET stations, which have like, basically sensor systems, and they're able to, measure, if there's snow on the ground, how much of it, that sort of thing. So I do know that there's MET stations and weather stations that, do provide information on what we're dealing with for weather. And that's about the extent of my knowledge of it. I don't know, Brett Schneider, if you have any more detail there than I do. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, like Mike said, it's kind of integrated and they can
I think the question is more like, what do you do with the snow once you know it's coming, it's on the ground? How do you deal with it? Do you have to remove it from the panels or do you have to plow? What do you have to do during operations?
I can speak generally to it. I mean, basically they're designed, that they're up a little higher in this area too. We're just building them up a little bit in the northern climate, but we're anticipating and planning to minimize obviously any physical moving of the snow as much as possible. But it isn't unheard of that we would have to move it in some cases. But generally you find like on the leading side of wherever the snow is coming from, similar to a snow fence, you'd probably have more of that snow on that front edge of the site. And then as it gets through the site, it'll be, thinner in general with obviously our high winds here. So if we do have to deal with it, it's going to mostly be on the edges. But generally we're trying to build them up a little bit higher so we will minimize that type of use. But from it coming off the modules, that is generally what happens, is that just with the sun being on the modules, a little bit warmer, when they do tilt, they're sliding off. So we don't anticipate a lot of of the snow. And so that's the high level story of how we deal with it.
And how high off the ground are they?
I think what's the latest, Brett, what's the latest design? Is it 30 inches at full tilt?
30 inch at full tilt. Yeah, that's kind of what we use for the northern climates, like our Minnesota sites.
So, and the full tilt, which, what part would be 30 inches?
The lowest part.
Okay.
And Jay, you talked, this was just in our prep, but you mentioned that you can also position them to avoid collecting. So when you know weather's coming, you position them in a certain way to avoid collecting snow, for instance.
Have you had them? What's the furthest northern climate you've operated?
We have a bunch of sites in Minnesota that are operating currently. Mike, do you know what to list any of those sites, I guess? But we have a little bunch through Minnesota.
And they're working out pretty well.
Yeah. There's sites in Minnesota, up in Ohio. And you're exactly right. So they'll go into a stow condition, or they can go into a stow condition, and it puts them at a pretty high angle so that the snow doesn't collect on them. And again, that kind of, I think, all feeds into that met station system, right? So it's being proactive. It does that for several weather events.
Cool. What about hail? How are these protected from hail?
Michael could probably comment to somebody. Or is that Mike? Maybe let me comment real quick, and then you can jump in. But I think part of that same example with the being able to tilt them, right? So a couple of factors is they're designed to try to take as much impact as reasonable. Can they get damage from hail? Yes. But basically you can try to minimize that by doing the tilt. And I don't know if there's any ratings that we have we could probably share. Michael or Mike could probably share that. But if there are damaged modules, then we would recycle those modules and replace them. And we obviously have insurance for those types of scenarios.
Mm-hmm. And Brett, I think you had talked in our prep about the size. It can handle pretty decent sized hail.
Yeah, I think Michael was commenting on it.
Yeah, so the panels that we're most likely going to use on this project are able to withstand up to 2-inch hail size. So that's not particularly common in this part of the country. And maybe just to further elicit some of the information on that, how do we actively manage hail protection? So as was mentioned, we are able to manually steer the trackers to a safe position. We also have outside weather warning services that are able to pick up severe thunderstorm and tornado warnings from the National Weather Service, and then that will connect to our operations center, and they will be able to take those warnings and immediately take action. And then some of the vendors are even working on a method to have the warning directly sent to the control system of the tracker itself. So there doesn't even need to be any human intervention.
Okay. Randy, I don't know if you have reclamation questions that you're asking about. I don't remember how we dealt with reclamation for this.
I was going to follow up on a couple questions that, because obviously you guys did provide a decommissioning plan with the initial application, but my presumption would be that the costs have gone up since then. Were you guys planning on filing an updated decommissioning plan for this?
Yeah, I can speak to that. So when we originally permitted this, there were no solar decommissioning rules, mm-hmm. and so we had provided a plan. What we're doing instead is just agreeing to comply with the current decommissioning rules. So that means there'll be the 5% construction phase decommissioning financial security, and then there'll be a decommissioning plan that meets the rules submitted prior to COD, and that will be the basis for the operations phase financial security. So basically replacing what we had done before with compliance with the rules.
Okay.
Yeah.
And still the same plan, the removal of the underground infrastructure to 4 feet, right?
Correct, yeah.
And so yes. Here's my question on that. The land, as I recall, there's only one or two landowners. Five? Okay. So are they explicitly informed of that and understand that? Or are they just presumed to be sophisticated enough to know what our rules are and that someday when this goes away, they're going to have a bunch of steel under there?
Yeah, so in our agreements, we specifically address decommissioning and have those commitments in our agreements as well.
Okay.
Yep.
In the life of this project, is still 20 to 25 years?
Speak to that. So when we do the general life of a module, maybe you'd think around that lifetime, they're going to have a, what we call in the industry, I guess, degradation. Like production might be slightly lower annually than the year before. And Michael can kind of correct me on our current technology, but I think it's sort of like, Michael's at less than 0.5% per year or something. You maybe correct me. But essentially, what from a site perspective, at a minimum, we would think of a lifespan around that 25 years. We have rights longer than that in our lease agreements, and we would, again, we don't have a crystal ball into the future of what energy will be, but my thought and expectation would be it could be longer than that, or our lease agreements are longer than that. Mm-hmm. But in any specific technology, I suppose it's no matter how you're generating it, you're going to evaluate that over time and look at current production of what you have versus what your new options are, and at some point you may, you know, repower or switch technology. But sure. Essentially, you know, when we, I guess the really high level concept is that when we build it initially, we're building it in a way where financially we know that it's going to run for an extended period of time to meet the commitments of the power purchase agreement that we're dealing with and financially be successful with the initial build. But we'll evaluate it over time to confirm if we'll update or extend or make it go beyond that period.
Okay. Who is your off-taker, are you able to say?
We are, yeah, Basin.
Oh, Basin.
Yep.
And so it's going into SPP?
It'll be MISO.
Hmm.
Okay. And Justin can talk. Justin, are you on? I know we're can't share a lot about it, but essentially the really big change from where we were last time, and I think you guys asked high level about it, but originally we were going through here, we'd done the land work, we'd done the surveys and studies, but the two big key pieces we didn't have the last time, which we were working through, was the interconnection agreement. Mm-hmm. We were in the study process, and we've actually gone through that multiple times to get to where we are, but we had, that was outstanding, and then which that agreement does lead to your ability to sign an actual power purchase agreement. Sure. You have your fixed, your primary costs. So since the last time, those are two very big things for the project, which enable us to have confidence to plan and move into the future. But yeah, it's Basin on this project. Justin, you want to add anything to that about MISO?
I don't think so. I would just add that, Basin has, they serve load in both MISO and SPP, primarily SPP, but they do have some load in MISO, and this project will allow them to serve customers and demand that they have in MISO. And also, they're North Dakota, a major North Dakota cooperative, and this fit really well with their needs.
Can you speak at all about what you ended up having to pay in terms of interconnection costs for this project?
Rafiq, are you on? Could you be able to answer?
I am on.
Perfect.
Yes, ma'am. So I'm pulling up the generation interconnection agreement to be very accurate, actually. So there are two parts of the payment. There is the interconnection cost, so the cost that you pay to go to the substation. And then you pay basically the rules of all RTOs, most RTOs, actually, is that if you break it, you have to fix it. So if you result in any kind of overloads, you end up paying for these upgrade costs. The total upgrade cost, let me pull it up here. Sorry, computers. Microsoft. Okay, so we have $6 million in interconnection costs. So that's the cost that's needed to reach, to modify the substation to interconnect there. And then we have $1.3 million, and that's to improve the MISO networks. And we have about another $1.6 million to improve our neighbors' electric networks.
Improve neighbors what?
Improve neighbors' electric system.
Okay. Yeah.
Any follow-up?
Nope, that's good.
Thank you.
And did you guys, or are you looking at all on adding batteries to this facility?
I can talk to that. At this time, we don't have it in the base plans. It's not in this permit, but it's something we will always evaluate. And it's going to be similar to the solar. Is there demand in this? Did the economics work? Mm-hmm. But it's not out of the realm of possibilities, but we'd have to come through this process again.
Does that require a different interconnection study?
It would not. There's different ways to do it. You could do it essentially like surplus your own interconnection and then do it underneath your, in our case, like a 200 megawatt site. You could do under that, but you'd always be capped at 200.
Right.
Or in other cases, you'd get your own interconnection and then be able to go above that. So it's kind of a business decision. But both are possible.
So this is more of a technical question. I'm sorry. But if you had a battery that, say, could store 200 megawatts, would you be able to, if you had the interconnection rights for 400, could you say you're at like peak time, technology's amazing, you can generate 200 megawatts at the site and your batteries are fully charged, would you be able to? Does the technology work where you could actually be providing both to the grid?
Yes. And we do this actively, just, I know it's not here, but we do this in Texas. In the ERCOT system, and we're, most of our sites there do have both, with separate interconnections, and we do provide, we have the option to max them out, both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suppose our northern climate sort of erodes the case for batteries, especially right now, because do they, in the middle of the winter, if you're trying to store, do the batteries lose that power because of the cold? Or
I don't know exactly. A lot of times, which maybe our technical guys can comment too, but I think it's interesting. My initial thought, I mean, we know sometimes cars, you know, are harder with the batteries, but in some cases, heat's tough on them too. You know what I mean? So keeping them cool is also, keeping them in that operating range is effective. So like solar modules, for example, the cold is better. If you have enough sunlight, keeping them cool is good. Mm-hmm. I won't be able to speak on all the battery technology there, but I do know that, I don't know that it has as much to do with the heat and cold here. I think it's more the economic structure of how our utilities are set up versus Texas is a little more, you have more, a little more variation in price and a little different economic drivers there. So I think it's more of that than it is temperature.
Yeah. When we develop a battery storage system, we typically allow for augmentation. So as some of the batteries lose capacity and efficiency, we add additional batteries, and you know, so sometime out you add additional batteries, so that way you can keep your capacity up, or you can keep your, you know, continuing to store up to 200 megawatts or whatever. So usually over the life of the project, I think I have one that's 250 megawatts, and I think we have a case for augmenting like 8 during the life of the project. So,
cool. I'm going to jump back into the presentation. let's see. Here we
go. Nice segue.
You said that so nicely. You're like,
I'm just going to have a comparison summary here just over for the overall impacts. The project boundary, again, remains the same. direct impacts have decreased by 11.1 acres since our 2018 application. The laydown area yard has also decreased, and the project, the entire project area, will also be revegetated and included in our calculations. You can refer to table 1.2-2 in our environmental report for more specifics. Now I'm going to talk about the exclusion and avoidance areas. So there are no exclusion areas identified within the project area. And again, back to avoidance areas and the wetlands that were found in our wetland delineations in 2023. So three wetlands were identified. You can find this in figure 6 of the handout that we provided to you. Again, they're small and they border the perimeter of the project boundary. Harmony Solar will avoid permanent impacts to all three wetlands. Any temporary impacts will be restored, and regardless, all three wetlands will be seeded with a wet prairie seed mix after construction. And there are no other avoidance areas within the project area. And I did have a slide on GIA and PPA. Jay, yeah, we covered it.
We covered this slide, maybe the next one. So we have the PPA GIA slide, which I went through that. The next slide is just on construction and operations. And so this is just related to the timeline. So we would, with these two kind of key pieces in hand, we are aggressively moving forward with some of the outstanding items we're still working through, as you know, signing a EPC contractor and some of the procurement items. So essentially, our plans would include starting construction as soon as this, you know, early 2025. And if we had any delays with the contracting or various procurement issues, that construction could start as late as 2027, second quarter of 2027. But obviously, we're pushing to do that sooner But that's kind of the range of possibilities. And then, so that would lead us to operations of the site. You know, essentially, if you think of this construction, will be that first year you start and then be operating by the end of the next year. So it's like almost two seasons of construction. So if we start 25, we'll be operating, you know, by the end of 26. And vice versa, if we were delayed some, it could go out to the end of 28.
And Basin's good with that?
Yes. Justin, you want to talk any commitments on there? I think it...
We call it a guaranteed COD date. That allows a lot of flexibility to further construction schedule. As you know, North Dakota, you never know about the weather. That can delay construction schedules. And so we do have a guaranteed COD date of 28. I think our target is 27, into 27. So it does allow for some flexibility on the COD.
I think in our ideal world, we'd start 25, be done by end of 26. But just, you know, trying to have some flexibility just in case we run into issues.
What's your increase in costs from your initial application to now?
Yeah, so now it's $320 million, and I think originally it was
250 million originally.
A lot of our siting projects, you know, there's beginning of construction and completion variables based on getting final approvals and things like that. But once they would have the final approvals, they don't have this kind of variance usually. Is it the solar panels that are the thing that are that cause a lot of question as to when you're gonna start construction? Or it seems like you have everything in place, and yet you don't know if you're going to start in 6 months or 30 months.
So before you answer that from a legal perspective, because of the continuing suitability, we have to specify what we're asking for as far as a timeline, and we don't want to come back again if there is a delay. this is similar to what we did the last time around with the New Frontier Wind Project, is we also asked for a range, and that was actually at that time the recommendation to ask for a range of from staff, just to make sure that we don't fall outside of the range. So that's one aspect of it, and then I'll let Jay talk to the technical side.
Yeah, so I think on the long lead items, we have plans in place. So for example, one big one on the modules, we have a overarching agreement with First Solar on modules that we've had for an extended period of time to secure that. And so we are internally, we still decide which projects they go to and how they're allocated, but we have plans for modules. We're still working on some of the inverter technology, inverter selections, some of those nuances. We have already started procurement on MPTs and breakers. So those large items we are, but I think we still, when we construct these, we hire an EPC contractor that has to provide other pieces of equipment. And there's just a lot of things that have to come together. As we've dealt with probably through the COVID period, we have a lot of plans, a lot of good plans, and all of a sudden procurement issues or things happen. So probably the biggest tone is probably what Molly said, is wanting to have flexibility to do what's reasonable and not come back unnecessarily. But we do have just want to let you guys know, we have the large pieces of the puzzle that we have plans and have some procurement agreements in place, but there are other details that need to be finalized, partly with us and partly with, depending on who we select for the contractor.
Okay. Just as a follow-up to that and a little bit to Sherry's question too, where are your parts coming from? Where are the panels coming from? Where are they made?
So our contracts with First Solar, it's actually a U.S. manufacturer. So this facility, is this the Ohio one? Maddie, is it Ohio?
Yeah, location?
Ohio. Ohio. I think they're made in Ohio.
And are they from start to finish, or do a lot of the components come from overseas?
I think, I don't know exactly all the nuance of the manufacturer. Maybe others here can comment too, but I think they meet the standard of like a 70% domestic 70% U.S. made blend, and that plays into some other things on the financial side, but they're the largest U.S. manufacturer of modules.
Okay. How have the federal tax credits changed since the first starting, since your original proposal? So it was $250 million cost. I'm guessing that the investment tax credit is a little different today moving forward than it was when you first looked at this. Can somebody speak to that?
Can't remember the exact structure that was in place in 2019. And now I would just, maybe I'll speak high level and without talking exactly how we're dealing with it on this project, but definitely the big change is the IRA being in place. Mm-hmm. And now projects we have, I think at that time, that would have probably been just an investment tax credit for solar, I guess. You know this better than me. I think originally it was probably a 30% tax credit. I think that got extended with the IRA, but now there's also options for a production-based credit. And I can't speak to exactly what we're doing on that one. But essentially now, in general, with this renewable industry and solar, we definitely have more of a longer runway, a little more certainty on what those plans look like. And then you have the additional option of the production-based credit or the investment-based credit. So
it's not both. It's one or the other.
Yeah. Yep.
A question on the panels. What's the warranty like? Because I know the technology has really changed. Has the warranty changed at all?
Michael, do you know anything about the warranties? Or anybody else on that line?
Sure. Sure. So the panels come with a 10-year workmanship warranty. So basically, physically they will, there won't be any damage or degradation issues in 10 years. And then a 30-year performance warranty, where they look at the, basically they warrant a level of performance degradation year over year, just as, it's really mostly related to kind of just the glass being else, and that warranty lasts for 30 years now, and some manufacturers are starting to extend it up to 35, but 30 is pretty much the standard.
Thank you.
Michael, could you speak to the degradation question. I mentioned it before, and I wonder if I just make sure I didn't mess that up too bad. What's the number on the production on our current modules?
Yeah, so First Solar specifically has an annual degradation warranty of 0.3% per year, which is a little bit better than, you know, than most of the rest of the industry, but it's due to kind of some of the unique nature of the modules themselves and how they're manufactured.
And how are they disposed of when you're when they are no longer being used?
Mike, are you able to speak to that?
Yep. So we have established a recycling program here at National Grid Renewables. So we went out to several several recycling companies in the U.S. and we selected one which meets our criteria. They safely dispose of the panel. They break apart all the elements within the panel, and then those individual elements are all recycled properly. So that's what we do for all of our damaged or panels that need to be offloaded, essentially.
So of the whole unit, what percent, say by volume, would you say is recycled versus put in a landfill?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I think I'd have to come back to you with that information. I don't have it off the top of my head. I know it's a significant amount of the panel is actually fully recyclable.
Yeah.
So, but I can get you that info.
Okay.
It also depends on what kind of modules we end up using. So they typically they're anywhere from like 85% to 96% recyclable.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on the modules we use.
Yeah. And then it also depends on what you're counting as 85% to 90%, you know?
Yeah.
How you measure.
Well, the glass, a lot of it's metal. Are you just talking about the modules themselves? Are you talking about the racking? All that is recycled as well.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Can you, what happens to the battery parts of it? You know, the actual.
The cell?
Yeah, the cell.
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know that one.
I mean, that's got the most toxic stuff in it, I would assume.
There's no toxic stuff in it.
Yeah.
None? Hazardous. Yep. I've had to answer that question before at another hearing. So we do also have an Appendix E, some updated, because last time around we were asked to provide some disposal recycling information. So we provided some updated.
Good.
So it has a figure that breaks down kind of what the different components are, and then it talks about by weight, more than 80% of a typical PV panel is glass and aluminum, and both are common and easy to recycle materials. And then there's some other things. So this gives a little
Perfect.
Bit more detail. We anticipated that maybe.
Good job,
question.
Molly.
This is our last slide here. So just as a summary, Harmony Solar continues to meet the conditions under which the project was originally permitted. We request an order finding continuing suitability and authorizing a construction time frame. Now I'm going to hand it over to Molly.
And I was just going to mention that Exhibit 2 that is in the binder takes each finding of fact and in each order provision shows what it was originally. And then if there were any updates, we noted that most of them are pretty small. So for instance, National Grid Development acquired Geronimo. So we updated who the parent company was that's assisting with development. We noted the wetlands in here, and we also indicated the commitment on decommissioning. So those are kind of the high-level ones that are the most significant changes, but nothing has changed as far as the overarching findings or conclusions.
Could you talk a little bit about your cyber and physical security plan?
Michael, did you hear that question? Is that something you want to discuss?
Unfortunately, I don't think I'm qualified to talk on that.
I didn't know if Mike's scores was or not.
Or Mike, the other Mike? Mike on the mic?
Yeah, I couldn't speak to the cyber side of it. I mean, I'm stepping outside of my bounds a little bit here, right? But just with our, like, our site emergency action plan and our site plan, you know, there's security measures that are put in place. The fences are all in place. All the gates are locked for entry and exit. Building is all locked. And so, you know, there is actual physical security in place. And then there's camera systems that are also in place for, you know, visual security as well. I couldn't speak to the cyber side of it, though.
Can you speak to our SCADA system at all? Just like how our system's connected to our operations facilities?
Yeah, I don't think I could give you the, you know, the big details in there, right? So, I mean, all the systems are connected through like a SCADA fiber network, right? And then they go to either the control house of the substation or to the controls, like SCADA rack inside of the O&M building, which it's then transmitted over to, you know, to our servers back home in Minnesota. So that's about the extent I could give you the detail there on.
And Jay, can you say that you comply with all applicable federal, you know, whatever cybersecurity laws are enacted? The plan would be that the system would comply with those, basically,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So your plant on site, that's operational. What time period? Monday through Friday, 24/7? What?
It'd be 24/7 operations. And I think some of it is monitored by, I guess, through our SCADA technology mm-hmm. system. And then I was trying to get to that. We have something on site, but we also have an operations center, you know, at our main office that monitors all of our different sites. And so we have these things monitored 24/7. And so, yeah, that's, and then from a practical perspective, I also say on a site like this, we're planning to have 3 or 4 full-time people that will be on site or around site. They're going to work like more of a typical work schedule for maintenance and working on the facility. But just to give you some context, you're going to have this area with modules. You're going to have people that are going to live and work in the area that's going to be their job to operate, maintain the site. And then on top of
three or four.
Three or four.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yep. And then, so I think you have that combination of like physical people on site doing that, and then you have the technology aspect that's going to, you know, be able to operate. We talked about before the modules will be tilted, and, you know, with the technology we'll monitor to determine when we got to bring people physically on site to do something with that. Yep.
And so this kind of gets back to just a little more information on Sherry's question about security. The 3 to 4 people, I presume, are generally daytime people. So is there anyone, like a security guard, that's out there all night to see if anyone comes out there tinkering around or something? Or is it
right.
3 to 4 people on a day shift and quiet at night?
Yeah, and I think it's more the we Mike can speak to it, but I mean, normally we don't have 24, you know, hours a day kind of monitoring for that type of safety security. But Mike can speak to the work schedules. Potentially, Mike, can you
answer? Yeah, I mean, that's accurate.
Yep.
Yeah, we don't have, like, security guards that stay in, like, a guard shack all night long, right? But the 3 to 4 people, the technicians on site, they're there for, you know, maintenance and operation of the plant. It's not necessarily daytime shift. Actually, there's quite a bit of nighttime work that takes place so you don't lose production during the day from the radiance, right? And also from a safety factor, you know, we find that, depending on the type of work, it's safer at times to work at night. So it really just depends on the scope of work, and, you know, like what's going on the plant as to when it's going to be scheduled. So, but they're like Jay said, their typical normal hours are during the day. It just, again, depends on the scope.
And I think you mentioned you had cameras too on site. So you do have some monitoring 24/7 from, you know, if there were an alarm, if there were an issue that came up.
I think this site, but it's been on other sites. I think if there was a safety or security issue, I think maybe heard of those on construction or theft or something like that. I think in those cases, you know, probably staff accordingly if there was some. I just have heard of that during construction, right? If things are getting stolen or things like that, you have to have a plan to monitor that and be aware of that. But for operations, it's not as common.
And what's your main office? You're talking about information goes to the main office. Where's that?
That's in Bloomington, Minnesota.
Okay.
So I think that concludes what we had to present, unless there's any more questions. We're planning to provide a proposed order, so we'll do that probably next week sometime.
Okay. Did you have any questions?
I don't.
As a portfolio holder?
I really appreciate you guys pulling together the whole team, so all the experts we needed were on the phone when you first went through the list. I was like, geez, they've got a lot of people here, but I think most of them got a chance to speak, so... So that was good planning on your part, and I think we got a lot of great questions asked and answered, and I already talked to Victor that we'll move forward as soon as we can to wrap this up.
Commissioner Haugenhofer?
Nothing else. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so then are there any objections to the evidence produced today, which would consist of the recording as well as the paper documents becoming part of the record?
No objection.
None here.
Okay, so then the evidence produced today will become part of the record upon which a decision will be made. Is there anything else for discussion today for the record?
Just because I have the three of you here, it might be worth just kind of recapping just the two issues. I know there are probably going to be some additional findings as a result of the changes, such as the financial assurances and the update to the decommissioning to match the administrator roles. But while we're here, is some sort of recommended language in relation to that post-construction fatality monitoring. Is that something that you'd like to see as well, either from staff or the company?
I think I would like to just include the company's commitment to ongoing, you know,
sure,
mortality studies as needed based, yeah, on the findings.
That's all I had.
Yeah, and we'll plan to put that language that we had. I think we have that language in the application somewhere. I'll put that in a finding.
Okay.
A fact.
Okay. Any other matters for the record? Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your participation, and this informal hearing is closed.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.